come to study number 5 on the family, and we saw 2 weeks ago the beginning of the opening up of the roles of the husband, and we've seen again by way of review and past studies on the family something of the motivations for a biblical family, the definition of a family, 6 component parts of what we are as human beings, and then last week we began to see the role of the husband. First of all, by looking at the introductory terminology of what husband means, or I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago, of what husbandry and what husband is, and we saw that the scriptures liken our relationship to our wives as that as being those who cultivate a garden, those who cultivate a field, and that our wives, as it were, are a field or a garden that we are to seek to be fruitful, bringing forth and bearing forth fruit in them. We saw 3 clarifications at that time that when we talk about the differences in the roles of men and women, that there are some similarities, that there are things that we would say that there is an equality in. We saw the 3 things: that we are equal in dignity of being created in the image of God, Genesis 1:27, that we are equal as fallen in Adam, Romans 5:12, that all sinned in Adam, and that we are also equal in redemptive privileges in Christ, Galatians 3:28, that in Christ there is no male nor female. But we are looking not at the dignity or who is better, but what functions God has given husbands and wives in the family. And we saw last week that he is, or excuse me, again, 2 weeks ago, that the husband is to be the primary material provider for the household. And I'll slip quickly go past that because we spent the majority of our time on that as well as the introductory terminology. But we come to point number 2 this week, and we'll see how far we get. I'm hoping to get through all of this material this morning. We'll see how we do. But the second thing that the husband is and the father is in a family, in a biblical family, is that he is to be the general administrator of the household. He is to be the general administrator of the household. Now, the primary summary title and role of the husband is that he is the head of the household. And by using head, we're using a terminology which we mean not an oppressive king, but rather the administrator, the director of the household. And this terminology, of course, comes from 1 Corinthians 11, if you'll turn there, please. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where Paul is discussing the thorny issues of head coverings and how those things apply in the Corinthian culture and some of the problems they were having in the church. And in 1 Corinthians 11, and we read in verse 3, I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Now this is the head of every woman is man, not in general, as if all men are the heads of all women, but rather in the context, it is the man, the husband, is the head of his own wife. So I'm not the head of your wife. You as men are not the heads of my wife. I am the head of my wife, of my gune, of my wife or of my woman. This is also seen in Ephesians chapter 5. And we'll talk about what it means to be a head in just a moment. In Ephesians 5, verse 23, going back to verse 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And we'll open that up when we get into the issue of the roles of women. Verse 23, the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Now, in the analogy of a head, it doesn't merely mean one that bosses other people around. But in the analogy, the head of a body doesn't boss the body unless the body is sinning and it has to be buffeted and put into subjection. But rather, the head is seen as the director for the good of the body. My head functions for the good of and protection and nourishment and comfort of my body. My body is not in contradiction to my head, but rather they work together, they work in tandem, and they're supposed to work in harmony. We would say of someone whose body acts contrary to his head is that they're either very sick or they're senile or they're demon-possessed or something like that, that there's something very dysfunctional about a head and a body that don't work in harmony together. And that's some of the illustration, that the head thinks and it moves and it is the central, it is where the brain is to be the general administrator of my body for the good of the body. So when I drink, reach out and my mind and my brain through the optical nerve sees this glass of water and I can feel that my body is thirsty, the brain acts to tell the hand, okay, reach out, grab this, bring it to your lips, take a sip, and it's not because the head is being bossy, it's because the head sees and feels the need of the body for a sip of water, and for the good of the body, tells the hand to reach out, the lips to open up, the esophagus to open, and to swallow the water. And so this must be seen, that when we're talking about a head, it's not the tyrannical king of the head who does everything for his own good, but rather it is the head that does and works and if you will, directs the body for the good of the body. Now, since the fall, let's go back in Ephesians 5:28, since we're there in Ephesians, we notice verse 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. And again, we see a self-interest there, that the head works with the body for the good of the body itself. Now, since the fall, the great problem with this role is that that men have the tendency to want to lord it over or to rule out of outside of the context of love. Well, notice back in Genesis 3 and verse 16, part of the curse that comes as a result of Adam and Eve's first transgression, in Genesis 3:16, he says to the woman, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. And then the second major category has to do with her relation to her husband, Adam. Your desire shall be toward or for your husband. And the idea is to rule over him, but he shall rule over you. And so the rule that starts to take place with Adam is not a gracious headship, but it is a rule from a fallen heart. So suddenly Adam has become selfish. Suddenly Adam is fallen. He has sin. And so the rule that he begins to exercise is that of what we might call a chauvinism. And chauvinism, male chauvinism, is a distortion of the headship of a man. It is wrong-headed because male chauvinism does what it does for self-motivating factors. I want to show my power by oppressing my wife, by oppressing my children. I want to show what a man I am by doing this and that and the other thing. And it is self-terminating. It's something that is driven by one's own selfish desires. Rather than doing the good and leading the household for the good of the household and for the good of the wife, male chauvinism is a twisting and a distortion of the headship that God has given man. But now notice there's a dual problem. There's one, he shall rule over you, but her desire now is to be toward her husband. And that's not talking about natural affection, because remember, this is a part of the curse. So in understanding this, it is for her to rule over him. She wants him to be passive. She wants to lead. She wants to be the one who becomes the head in her fallen state. So since the fall, there has been an imbalance. His rule has been that of domineering rather than loving direction. And even in patriarchal societies, that can often be seen. I mean, in, for instance, Muslim countries, the husband is definitely the head of the wife. But that's not what we're talking about, because she does his every will and whim. That's not the headship. It's not the headship of Christ. It's not the headship of love. And so that is one demonic imbalance and distortion of headship. Just as with Adam, the soil is not going to be naturally yielding to his labors. He's going to pull out thorns and thistles, and from the sweat of his brow, it is by sweat that he will work it. So likewise, his headship of the woman will be with difficulty, partially because of his own sin, because his response is, woman, submit. Let me be the man. Let me be the head. But the other problem is partially because of her desire to rule over him. That's what we see from Genesis 3:16. His sin, which makes this difficult, would include self-centeredness. That is, she exists for my good, and it ultimately terminates on me. But also his sin of laziness, where a man may say, I don't have the time or strength to love her as I should, so it's easier just to tell her what to do. Now, I want us to see several things regarding the general administration of the household from a couple of passages. The first is 1 Timothy 3. Having established that God has determined that it is man who is the head of the wife, and notice here, now I'll come back to that application in just a moment, but 1 Timothy 3, verse 4, what we mean by headship is not, again, this oppressiveness, but rather to rule his house well. 1 Timothy 3, in verse 4 and 5, and the qualifications of an elder, which we just saw a few weeks ago, is one who rules his own house, but he just doesn't rule it. He rules his house well. He does it in a good way. He administrates his household in a way that it's obvious that he is the head and he is a good head of his household, having his own children in submission with all reverence. If a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? So we see that the responsibility of an elder is what he must be, which is a pattern of what every Christian man should be. It just happens to be that he has to be that to be qualified as an elder. So here, the proclivity to rule without love can lead... that's part of my next point. But here we see that it is a rule that he does exercise, and we shouldn't be afraid of the terminology, but it is a ruling well of his household. The next passage is Ephesians 6 and verse 4. Ephesians 6, 4, where we see the rule of the husband is not for the overt oppression of his children that will do things to them just by him being bossy and snapping his fingers at them and stomping his foot and immediately expecting them to respond, doing things that will, we see in Ephesians 6, 4, provoke them to wrath. In Ephesians 6, 4, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. Here the father is to be sensitive to his children so that he isn't, again, the king that's just barking out orders, telling his children, expecting them, like the Von Trapp children, to come all in line and do exactly what he says. But rather, he's a man who doesn't provoke his children to wrath. He's sensitive to them. So it is his responsibility to give godly direction and motivation to not only his wife, but also to his children. So we see under the second point, he is to be the general administrator of the household. He is, in the summary terminology, the head. Now, by way of application, we see that the head is what the husband is. It doesn't matter if he exercises it well or not. It's what he is. It's what God has said. The head of every woman is the man. Man is the head of the wife. Now, the question is he a good one or is he a bad one? Is he doing it well or is he misrepresenting the character of God by doing it in an oppressive way? But whether he does it well or he doesn't do it well, he still stands accountable before God to exercise that headship. Even though he may abdicate his headship, he still stands before God accountable for being such. So that's the second thing that we've seen. First, he is the primary material provider. Second, he is the general administrator of the household. And some of what that means will be fleshed out in these next three points. So any questions or comments at that point? All right, then third, I want us to see that the husband, the role of the husband in relation to his wife and to the children, is he is to be the closest companion, confidant, and friend of his wife and children. He is to be the closest companion, confidant, and friend to his wife, but even also to his children. Notice over in 1 Peter 3, a passage we've looked at before when we were preaching through 1 Peter. 1 Peter 3, he is to be the wife's closest companion, confidant, and friend. Do we view our wives, men, as our friends, and really as our best friends? Notice in 1 Peter 3, 7, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Notice here that the husband, first of all, is to dwell with his wife. That means to inhabit a place together with her. It means to spend time with her. It means to be friends with her. That means that his hobbies, his companionships and friends of with other men, that these various things should not rival his time with his wife. That the first part of this is that a man dwells with his wife. The second is that he must do so with understanding. He must understand her. As we've seen before, the two books, if you will, of coming to understand our particular wives, first is the Word of God that gives us some general principles of what women are in general, but then the second book is her own heart. And the only way that that heart can be read is by pulling her heart out of her. That is, by talking to her, asking her her hopes, asking her dreams. What are her fears? What are her struggles? So that it's not just, well, I know what women are according to the Bible, but particularly, what is my wife? And the only way to read the book of her heart is to dwell with her in an understanding way. What can she handle? How much pressure is too much pressure on her? What kind of things does she get caught up with that I need to help her to re-engage and to refocus? So it assumes a dwelling with them, and it assumes a dwelling with them in an understanding way. And husbands, are we reading our wives? Do we know the hearts of our wives? Are we responding to the hearts of our wives? And then the third thing he says in this passage, 1 Peter 3:7, is that he is therefore to give honor to her. And again, this rails against the male chauvinistic, I'm king and you're not mentality, but rather to give honor, that is to treat her with dignity and with chivalry. It is to be a servant to her, because one whom you give honor, you take a lower place. That there's that sense that I am here to serve you, I am here to do good to you, and to give honor, just like we would honor a king or a president or somebody of high power, we would honor them in appropriate ways, which assumes thinking of them as better than ourselves in some way. So likewise, we are to give honor, that is, treating them with dignity and chivalry and being a humble servant to our wives. Isn't that the headship of Jesus Christ, that he is first and foremost known as the servant of the Lord, that he is the one, he says, as he washes his disciples' feet, what I do for you, what you see me do, do also to one another. And just as Christ loved the church, not coming to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, so we as men are to serve our wives, to serve them. And our big goal is not that we be served. Now, we'll see also in this issue of his closest, of the wife's closest companion, confidant, and friend, I want us to see something from Genesis 2:24 as well. In Genesis 2:24, Adam, in response to the creation of the woman, says something that in the context, let me pause here to say that verse 23, it's definitely the case that Adam says, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. There's some question, though our Bibles typically take one view, there's some question whether Adam makes the application himself, and therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, or I think more likely that it is Moses who then, writing the book of Genesis, then makes an application and a comment on what he's just said in verse 23. The comment is, verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So the point I want us to see from this verse is that as much as a child is supposed to honor and show dignity to the parents, that there is a sense that that relationship is temporary compared to his relationship with his wife. Right? Because here you have the man who is honoring, he's to cherish and honor his mother and father, but it says here that he shall leave his father and mother and be joined or cleave together to his wife. There's one that's something of a more temporal nature, something that is shorter lived, but the two shall become one flesh. And that's not said of parents and children. But here, there's something of a temporary nature that I leave my parents for the purpose of cleaving to my wife in that one flesh relationship, which here, as I'm saying, is the closest companion, confidant, and friend, that she becomes my one flesh, that she is my best friend. I'm to be her best friend, her confidant, her closest companion. Now, this doesn't say what should be, but what is. The two shall become, he shall be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That we are one flesh with our wives. Now, again, we can do it poorly or we can do it well, but that is what we are nevertheless. So while the parents are to be treated with this honor and dignity, his primary responsibility is to his wife, even over the parents and the children. Let's also look at Ephesians 5, which is, again, another parallel to this Genesis passage, where this is fleshed out even a bit more. In Ephesians 5, in verse 28 and 29, we see that this one flesh relationship, it's not merely a physical thing, but there is a joining together in a spiritual nature. Notice in Ephesians 5:28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh. Notice that, the flesh, that when I marry her and we are joined together in the physical union, she becomes flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. Just as Adam and Eve were taken from the same flesh, there's a spiritual parallel. So we're told that, verse 29, no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Because the nature of the relationship is a cleaving together and becoming one body, he has now the responsibility to nourish and cherish her, just as we have responsibility to do so to our bodies. Now, the first word here translated in the New King James, nourish, is ektrepho, which means literally to nourish or to feed. It is the idea that for the good of my body, I nourish it. At lunch today, I will take some food into my body for the good and for the strength of my body. This can also mean to bring up or to educate. And I think both of those ideas are implied with this idea. So I am to work, and I am to apply myself for the good of my wife, who is part of my body, that she might be nourished, that she might be brought up, that she might be healthy, a healthy body. That's part of my responsibility as a husband. Now, the second word here is cherish, which is thalpo, which means to impart warmth. It means to comfort. It means to tenderly care for like a mother to her children. The same word is used in 1 Thessalonians 2 when it says, just as a 1 Thessalonians 2:7, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children, so we're told in Ephesians that the husband is to cherish his wife. That doesn't mean to treat her like a child, but rather to be caring toward her, to be tender toward her, to be comforting toward her, so if you will, that she is warmed by his love. So to nourish and to cherish. This is not the picture of the hard man who's the king of his home, who everybody serves him, who is uncommunicative, who doesn't want to talk, who doesn't want to communicate with his wife, who's uncaring for her concerns because he has the burdens of his vocation, but rather of a tender, warming, and caring servant. Now, Paul maybe seemed to be a little overboard in his statement here in Ephesians 28 that no one ever hated his own body. That might seem like an overstatement, because don't some seem to hate their own body by abuse or by neglect? Don't some indeed hate their own bodies? So it may be seeming here that he goes a little bit overboard, but who is it that neglects, and what is at the root of the neglect or the harm of the body? Well, if you'll turn to Mark 5:5, we'll see the nature and the character of what neglect of the body is. In Mark 5:5, here they come to the Gadarenes, to the country of the Gadarenes, and the Lord Jesus, as the men get out of the boat, we read in verse 2, when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, neither could anyone tame him. He had a supernatural, demonically imparted power. And keep that in mind if you're ever flipping through the stations and you see these guys that seem to be able to talk with the spirits. I mean, this is a big craze now. There are two guys, at least, that I know of, and I can't remember their names now, but they'll have this reading. They'll have all the people in this room, and they'll be able to walk around and say, okay, I'm getting some vibes over here, somebody named Charlie, Charles, and say, oh, yeah, I know somebody. Okay, well, there's something here about a dog. Yeah, oh, yeah, well, he was killed walking his dog. And, you know, some of that is just plain sham, but we must remember there are demonic and spiritual powers at work. And because there can be demonstrated certain things and certain powers, apparently for good, doesn't make them right. We see from the example of the gospel here is a man with superhuman strength, but it was demonically imparted. So let's not forget the reality of the spiritual realm, and just because something seems real doesn't validate it as godly. So hopefully that will give us some discernment with all the foolishness that takes place on the tube at times. But now notice Mark 5:5, and always night and day he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. He was taking and he was calling out till his voice would be hoarse from the demons, and he would take up stones, sharp stones, and cut his body and hurt his body. He would strip his body naked, exposing it to the elements. He obviously was not eating or doing the kind of things that would be good for his body. We can't picture him sitting down to a nice meal and saying, okay, well, let me say, have a nice salad here. And obviously he was neglecting himself. He was cutting himself. He was hurting himself. But what is at root of this? At root of this is demonic possession. It is demonic in its core. In common grace. Yes.
And that may be even true today for people that have used themselves.
Well, whether it's demonic possession or not is up for debate, but it's certainly demonic. It's not from the Lord. Every good and perfect gift comes from above. But the whole movement of body mutilation and piercings and tattooings, I'm convinced, is demonic. I mean, it is the hurting of the body, the piercing of the body, the cutting of the body, and some of it gets very, very, I mean, it's distorting the image of God. Stephen?
I'd say that many people think that's an extreme excuse, their own responsibility to their temporal bodies by, you know, well, I can't help it, the devil made me do it temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I'm pretty confident, though we don't have the history of the Gadarene, that he was a man who had opened himself up to demonic spirits. And I think that it's a man who did not love righteousness, but he gave himself to wickedness and eventually opened up himself to this kind of thing. So, yes, it's not the old Flip Wilson, the devil made me do it. The devil doesn't make you do anything. You open yourself up, and then there's a slavery and control of sin and the devil. But the point I'm trying to make here from, in the contrast to Ephesians 5, when Paul says that no man hates his own body, that's not a universal absolute. He's saying by way of a general principle. It's only those who are just out of their minds who do things to hurt their body. It just doesn't make any sense, even in common grace. Now, let's comport that over to a man who's insensitive and uncaring toward his wife, who cuts her with his words, who dishonors her, who is always critical of her. Now, is that any less demonic? To take his own body and to cut her? There are words, Proverbs says, that go deeper and cut deeper than knives. We're told in Proverbs 8:21 that in the power of the tongue is life and death. So men, are we shaken by that? That every time that we're short and hypercritical and are not sensitive to our wives, not that we're demon-possessed, but that doesn't come from the Father. That comes from our sinful flesh, and it's more reflective of the devil and of demonic power than it is of righteousness. May we take our words to our wives very seriously. May we take our refusal to feed them, to nourish them, to comfort them, to cherish them as very serious. You say, well, I didn't have a dad that taught me that. It doesn't matter. We have the Word of God to instruct us. We have examples in church history. That means we're going to have to mortify our sin, but an uncaring, unloving, and a man with a critical spirit, and whenever we demonstrate that, we've got to realize the source is from what it is. And as Stephen pointed out, we can't say, well, that's just the way it is. That's my nature. Well, it may be, but it's fallen nature. It's fallen nature, and it has to be mortified and overcome by the Spirit. So here's my point. It is acting demonically for a man to neglect and not nourish and cherish his wife. Now, this great motivation is that she may be presented pure before the Lord. Again, Ephesians 5:27. I'm wanting to press this on our conscience as men, and I doubt that any of us couldn't do better in these areas. Ephesians 5 and verse 27, that his purpose is that he might present it to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. That's Christ's motivation to love his church and to be the head of the church. That also ought to be our motivation, that our wives be presented to Christ, not crippled, but rather enabled and loving to worship him. We are desirous, we should be desirous, to help our wives in holiness, that they, by our influence, might be more pure and more holy and more upright and more joyful and more having a sense of peace in the light of difficulties. So there's heading number 3. He is to be the closest companion, confidant, and friend of his wife. Some of this secondarily goes to the children as well. But first and foremost, we're seeing the relationship of the husband and the wife. Okay, any questions, comments on that? Stephen? You can often tell when, I mean, we're all like this to some degree, particularly in the ladies. I know of a sister in Louisville who is going through a very, very difficult time, and it's obvious. I mean, she carries it in her countenance. All right. Well, may God give us help to be the kind of encouragement and help to our wives, that they do walk not 3 steps behind us, groveling behind us, but rather to walk as confident women before the Lord. All right, number 4. He is to be his wife's sensitive and willing lover. To be his wife's sensitive and willing lover. For this, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7, we'll read verses 3 and 4, then also verse 33. 1 Corinthians 7, is Paul is dealing with some of the issues that through this chapter become very difficult to sort out, and exactly what he means and how much of it is of a temporal nature regarding what he says in verse 26 of this present distress, and how much of this comports over to our own day. There are some things that I think that are very clear. In chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. And we'll come to that later. But notice verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. More accurately, the New American Standard states here in verse 3 that the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife. New King James imports in here affection, and I think in the context that's right, and that's certainly the emphasis and focus. But what we're told here is there are certain things that are due my wife. There are certain things that are due. And it is the Greek word aphale, which means to owe somebody a debt that you must pay. There are certain things that my wife, I owe her, that I have a debt to pay her, that there is an obligation, there is a duty. There's something that if not paid, there are legal repercussions, is the idea here. So the New American Standard, again, rightly says the husband must fulfill, must pay, must keep his obligation to his duty to his wife. The very fact that she is his wife means that he has certain obligations to her in the marriage covenant. Doesn't matter if she does or doesn't do certain things. Because they are married, there are certain things due her. If she fails at everything she's supposed to do and does absolutely nothing right, that doesn't negate the responsibility and the duties that are owed toward her. In the context, it seems to be the appropriate bodily affection that she desires. What does that mean? Sitting on the couch holding her hand? Maybe. But if that's what she desires, that's what we ought to give. Is it just sitting under the blanket in front of a warm fire? Is it drinking a hot cup of cocoa late at night? Is it some... doesn't matter what it is, the husband has the obligation to find out what are the things that please her, and if it's not sinful and I can do it with a good conscience, then that's my desire. And why is it? Because, as he says in verse 4, my body and what I do with my body when I get home from work isn't just my decision. But there's a sense that I owe her, and I am obligated to her. And ask her, what do you want me to do? My body is not my own. What do you want me to do with my body? What is appropriate? What are the things that are going to help you? Well, maybe she just wants a back rub. Maybe she wants her feet rubbed. I got to confess, that's something I struggle with. But, okay, is that what she wants? Is that what she desires? Is that what will help make her feel nourished and cherished and warm? He is to be her sensitive lover. That is, what is it, I'm going to get a little blunt here, but what is it that pleases her in the sexual union? What is it that displeases her? What are things that makes her comfortable? What are the things that make her uncomfortable? At the end of the day, it's not like a pornographic movie where she exists for the good and for the pleasure of the man to do his every will and whim, but rather, I'm here to please you. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to make you feel good. The main goal and desire is not just so I can have my fill, but what is it that pleases you? That's what the verses here, I believe, mean. He does not have authority over her body, or she does not have the authority over her body. The husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And we'll come to that later when we deal with the duties of wives. But there are certain things that are due and obliged to them. And then notice in verse 33, he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, physically, emotionally, spiritually. I care for the things of the world, how I may please her. To ask her simple questions like, sweetheart, do I please you? What kind of things do I do that don't please you? What kind of things do I do that do please you? What am I not doing that you would want me to do that would help you to be more pleased? again, whether physically, emotionally, spiritually. The driving motivation is not what he desires, but what she desires, which takes humility, which takes self-denial, which takes the eyes off ourselves and puts them in our hearts upon our wives. So that's what I mean here by her sensitive lover and her willing lover.